Great. Yep. Hello, good evening, everybody. I'd like to begin by thanking the English Department for sponsoring this annual contest and awards ceremony and the library for hosting this event. We'd like to thank all the creative writing students for their hard work, inventiveness, and dedication to practicing their craft. We are so happy to have Richard McCann here, and I am honored to be able to introduce him. I did my MFA in creative writing at American University, and Richard was my teacher, one of the very best teachers I've ever had. And I'd like to speak then by way of introduction, not only about his writing, his fiction, his poetry, his creative nonfiction, yes, he does it all, but also about the Richard I remember, the masterful teacher from the creative writing classroom. Let me begin with a quick look into Mother of Sorrows. Many of these stories in this interwoven collection are set in suburban Maryland among a sunstruck subdivision of identical brick houses. Houses in these stories take on all sorts of important capacities and connotations that I don't have time to go into here, but specifically, Mother of Sorrows begins with a birdhouse, or more accurately, with a narrator's father at work on another birdhouse. They are his labor of love, his father says. And we understand, perhaps, he is building a more contained, more known, more precious version of the life, the house, the family he already has in front of him. The father here reminds me a little of me as an MFA student, or if I could generalize, of me and my cohort of MFA peers that studied under Richard. We would come to workshop with our manuscripts, our precious projects, our birdhouses that we had been tapping and sawing away at in great earnestness. And Richard would do this controlled demolition on them. He'd destabilize our birdhouses, gently disassemble them, and in the process find all sorts of unfinished things we hadn't realized were there. Loose panels, incomplete framing, tilting bookcases, leaning stairways. Yes, all these things can occur from time to time in birdhouses. These were things we were hiding, things that were hidden to us, trap doors, even in our birdhouses. Richard would always find these structural oddities and see not flaws, not things to sand over or saw out, but rather places to look for more meaning, more conflict, greater depth. He'd always point them out and say, to our great embarrassment, "What about that? Can we hear more about that? I think you really need to work more on that." And we would leave class with a new view into our own writing, our manuscripts, post-demolition, now potentially in violation of code, were much less precious, so much more dangerous and interesting than we had thought they were. Richard was never easy in the classroom. He never let bad writing shuffle out the door feeling good about itself, but he was also, at the same time, never unkind to the writer. He was always both the most generous and exacting of critics. I feel deeply privileged to have been one of his students. Richard's own writing has been received publicly and critically with great acclaim. His creative nonfiction has appeared in Best American Essays. His interwoven collection of stories, Mother of Sorrows, won the John C. Zacharias Plowshares Award in 2005. Ghost Letters, a collection of poetry, won the Beatrice Hawley and Capricorn Awards. He has been the recipient of grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. He is currently working on a memoir, The Resurrectionist, about his experience as a liver transplant patient. I believe, and this has been said by others, that there is a great attention to and reverence for the body in Mother of Sorrows in all of Richard's work. He writes in a tradition that includes E.M. Forster and Diane McCoskey, whose work I know Richard has long admired. And in this tradition, it's the body, not the idea, nor any doctrine or theory to which we should turn, maybe in the end the only place to which we can turn. The body is the locus around which all our experience takes on form and meaning. Richard's poems and essays and stories consider the body in many states and attitudes. The body restored to health, but at the cost of another's life. The body ravaged by AIDS or by drugs. The fragile body, the tender body, the body's need for tenderness. And to the body full of desire. Richard is certainly interested in the concupiscence of the body. Always, too, in Richard's writing, there's a kind of struggle, a struggle that plays out among characters, a struggle produced within the reader, over interpretation for how things are to be seen. Here is the narrator of Mother of Sorrows as a child at school watching civil defense newsreel of a nuclear detonation. Yet, as the cloud rose, it grew calmer, spreading out lazily in all directions, like summer cumulus carrying a dream cargo of familiar faces. When the lights came on, some students told the warden what they'd seen within the mushroom camp. Someone had seen Abe Lincoln's face as it appeared on a penny. Someone had seen his mother's. It was a mistake, the warden said, to look at it like this. I was at a reading of Richard's once 7, 8, 9 years ago, and after, during Q&A, someone from the audience asked, maybe a little impatiently, why did that essay have to be so sad? And the way he asked it was like a challenge. Why does it have to be so sad? I think because he had been challenged in some way by what he just heard, and it bothered me, this question, in that it seemed to insist that the essay match him, his sensibility, step for step. When he was ready for the string section to come in, where was it? When he had wanted to hear a plucky crescendo, why hadn't it arrived? Then another person, someone else in the audience, spoke up, someone braver than me, and she said, why is it so sad? Because life is like that sometimes. Richard writes unflinchingly about loss. These stories in Mother of Sorrows are populated with aging movie stars and faded nightclub singers, with household artifacts that recall a bygone generation, and with characters who look backward, trying to discover themselves within and remake themselves out of their pasts. Moreover, these stories don't pretend to reclaim what was lost. They don't present an easy transcendence. We don't rise above loss or emerge from out of it or shed it or leave it behind. Rather, these stories remind that it is a necessary debt of living to feel loss, and that we will feel it not abstractly, but often bodily. That feeling, that pang, that absence itself is the very thing that connects us to our own particular past, a past which, of course, we have lost, which we are losing by the second. If we try to shake loose of our loss, McCann's stories tell us, we're trying to shake loose of our past. We're trying to shake loose of ourselves. On the night their father dies, Davis, the narrator's brother, climbs the willow tree in their backyard and whispers down to the narrator and their mother sitting below. Hello down there, he says. Who goes there? Who goes there in the dark? Later in the work, Davis himself dies, a young man of a drug overdose. But his words, who goes there? Who goes there in the dark? Echo for the narrator even until the end of the collection, and echo for this reader long after. This image, Davis whispering from his tree, comes to illuminate the division between the living and the dead. It's an image, too, that invokes in many ways Joyce's lyrical, past-haunted, the dead, with the snow falling, gently falling, and Greta's lost love waiting for her in the freezing rain by the wall under a tree. In Mother of Sorrows, death, what we lose to death, the mystery of death, the otherness of death is evoked by Davis, who speaks in the end from offstage, from the wings, from out of memory, from above the narrator and his mother, hidden in the branches of a willow tree. Who goes there in the dark? And Davis's question is answered at the end of the book. We do. We go. We continue. We are among the living. And these beautiful stories urge, for that reason alone, we need to take care of each other. Please join me in extending the warmest of welcomes to Richard McCann.
That was so beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Jim Porter, star student. That was the most beautiful introduction I've ever heard of myself. I've heard of some other, that one of Whitman, I remember, from the 19th century. Thank you a lot for that, Jim. You made my book sound so good. I'm really glad to be at Michigan State, and I've had a really nice time talking with a lot of students today, undergraduates and graduate students. And being asked and thinking about questions that I'm not quick enough to think of, and so I'm glad to be asked. Also, I just wanted to say that I've had a really nice time meeting the faculty here, Jim, of course, and Marcia and Robin, and Steve and Jeff. And also, I don't mean to humiliate you, but also to finally meet Diana McCoskey, whom Jim mentioned was a big influence on me. You know, you're students, so maybe I'll mention it, but I was a college student in the South, and one of the things that meant, particularly in my era, was that we read completely different works than you from the Midwest or they from the North would have read. And so when I first started, and I started first as a poet before becoming a prose writer, the poems I read were poems by John Carl Ransom and Donald Davies, and poems coming in very much out of the Southern tradition, and often formalist poems, and many beautiful, beautiful, beautiful poems. They weren't my poems. I remember sort of wondering, you know, where were the voices that were not so stately, simply stately, that felt more real to me. And I actually got it out of the bookcase because, I mean, and this book, Inside the Blood Factory, was one of the first books I found by Diane Wachowski that opened language for me in a new way. And I think maybe that's a way of saying it opened the tradition of Whitman for me, you know, a less formalist tradition and a tradition in which language could be much bigger and voice could be much more, much more unexpected than I had ever imagined it to be. So I'm really grateful to you. And I don't mean to embarrass you because then I'll read all this horrible stuff and like be like, ugh, you know, like who'd want an influence like that? But I am grateful indeed. I thought I'd read you two things. One very short thing. That Jim read a line from, actually. I thought I'd read you the very first little piece. I'm not using the word story because I don't think it's a story from Mother of Sorrows. And it's a piece that I wrote and seemed kind of homeless for, I don't know, a bunch of years because it wasn't a story. And I kept thinking what to do with it. And then when this book was done, I realized I could put it in the beginning of this book. So I made me very happy. And it's very short. And this is... Although this book often reads like a memoir, it's a work of fiction. But in this story, in this one non-story story, this is my mother. Okay, this is her, the real person. And it's called Crêpe de Chine. And I think the only things you need to know, if you don't know, that being born with in a call, C-A-U-L, that kind of call, if you're Irish, means that you have the sixth sense, a gift of premonition. And the other is that the Sherry Netherlands was and remains a very sort of exclusive hotel in New York, not the one that we wouldn't think that the public knew of, but the other one. And the Stork Club was a nightclub that was very, very big until its closure in the 60s, I guess, in Manhattan. Crêpe de Chine. Each night after dinner, my father went downstairs to his workbench to build birdhouses, which he fashioned from scraps of wood left over from pine paneling our basement. He was a connoisseur of birdhouses, my mother said. His favorite was a miniature replica of our ranch house with a tiny plexiglass picture window, a red Dutch door, and a shingled roof. It was a labor of love, he said, the night he completed it. My brother Davis went to his room where he listened to Radio Moscow on his shortwave. As for me, I cleared the table. Sit with me, son, my mother said. Let's pretend we're sitting this dance out. She told me I was her best friend. She said I had the heart to understand her. She was 46, I was 9. She sat at the table as if she were waiting to be photographed, holding her cigarette aloft. Have I told you the story of my teapot, she asked, lifting a Limoges pot from the table. She'd been given the teapot by her mother, whom we called Dear. Dear one, dear me, dearest of us all. Dear had just recently entered a sanatorium for depression after having given away some of her most cherished possessions. And when she died at home a few months later, she'd returned to her deteriorated Brooklyn brownstone, where she slept on a rollaway in the basement. My mother found she'd left an unwitnessed will written entirely in rhymed couplets. I spent as I went, seeking love and content, it began. No, I told my mother as I examined the teapot's gold-rimmed lid. You haven't told me about it. In fact, by then, my mother had already told me about almost everything. But I wanted to hear everything again. What else in Carol Knowles, our sunstruck subdivision of identical brick houses, could possibly have competed with the stories my mother would summon from her china, or her incomplete sterling tea service, or the violet Louis Sherry candy box where she kept her dried corsages? She whispered magic words, Crêpe de Chine, Sherry Netherlands, Haviland, Stork Club, Argent Repoussé. Night after night, she told me her stories. Night after night, I watched her smoke her endless parliaments, stubbing out the lipstick-stained butts in a crystal ashtray. We sat at the half-cleared table like two deposed aristocrats. She said her mother had once danced with the Prince of Wales. She said her father had shaken hands with FDR and Al Capone. She said she herself had once looked exactly like the movie star Merle Oberon. To prove it, she showed me photos of herself taken during her first marriage when she was barely 20. From every photo, she had torn her ex-husband's image so that in most of them she was standing next to a jagged edge, and in some of them a part of her body, where he'd had his hand on her arm perhaps, was torn away also. She said, life, 50-50, happiness and heartache. She said when she was a girl, she kept a diary in which she recorded the plots of her favorite movies. She said that if I was lucky, I too would inherit the gift of gab. When I was little, she read me Good Night, Moon. Good night, nobody. Good night, mush. And good night to the old lady whispering, hush. But otherwise, she read me no bedtime books. She told me no fairy tales. Instead, she came to my room at night to tell me stories that began like these. Once upon a time, son, I had a gold brush and comb set. Once upon a time, my parents looked like Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. Once upon a time, son, I rode a pony in Prospect Park. Once upon a time, I had a silver fox coat. Things she told me, sitting on the edge of my bed at night. I was born with a call, son. That means I have a sixth sense. Or, touching her perfumed wrist to my cheek, this is called Shalimar. Or faintly humming, do you know this tune? Do you know, when I grow too old to dream, I'll have you to remember? Or sometimes when she coughed, her nervous cough, her smoker's cough, she said, one day, after I'm gone, you'll hear a woman cough like this, and you'll think she is me. Oh, thank you. She was, yesterday was the anniversary of her death. Her mother and her grandmother both died on St. Patrick's Day, and I have a very strong feeling she was aiming for something like that. But off a day. It's interesting you mentioned Song of the Father, Jim. You made very beautiful birdhouses. That's all I recall. They were intricate and complex and filled with seed. Some of you in nonfiction have been read the section of a memoir I'm working on, or I don't know if memoir is the right word. I don't know what the word is, called The Resurrectionist, which has its epigraph, the beginning of Ovid's Metamorphosis, which book begins. It is my intention, it says Ovid, to tell of bodies that have changed forms. And this is a memoir about bodies that have changed forms, including my own body, because I went through I had a liver transplant 13 years ago, which in transplant time is a long time. And so I'm working on a series of essays. My agent always says, don't use that word, because it sounds so deadly. So a series of autobiographical narratives that have a meditative aspect on this experience. And some of you read one called The Resurrectionist, and I thought I'd read you one that's not too long, called Like a Fatherless Child. Because Jim, it's nonfiction, and it's about my relationship to my father, which changed significantly during the time that I was waiting for a transplant. But I won't bother to tell you about that because the essay is about that. And Like a Fatherless Child, I don't like this title so much, but it was supposed to invoke like a motherless child, you know, that song. So Like a Fatherless Child. For a long time, when friends asked me about my father, I told them I scarcely recalled him at all, except in fragments too small to reassemble. After all, I was only 11 when he died. I said he was a weekend fisherman. I said he liked sandwiches made of ketchup on white bread. He liked Gunsmoke, Perry Mason, The Untouchables, Rawhide. He liked to say, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich by now? If they asked how he died, I explained he died of fulminant liver failure when he was 50. That means he hemorrhaged to death. Blood poured from his mouth as if everything inside him had suddenly erupted. Not that I was there to witness it. I was too young to visit him in the hospital he'd entered a few days before. One evening, as he stood before the bathroom mirror, lathering his face with shaving soap, he noticed his eyes were slightly jaundiced. The next week, he was dead. And if people asked how I felt after his death, relieved, I'd say. By the time he died, I'd explain, I had already begun to see that I had disappointed him with my fretful giddiness, my penchant for tracing movie star photos from magazines and jumping rope with the girls in the schoolyard. You know, he once said when he overheard me gabbing on the phone with a neighbor girl, you don't need to be a chatty Cathy. The reason I hadn't really missed him was that I'd never really needed him in the first place, I said. I'd always belonged to my mother, sitting up late with her on Saturday nights to watch old movies on TV. In truth, it was almost exhilarating saying these things about my father, as if by repudiating the bond between us, I could somehow punish him for having loved me insufficiently, or perhaps for having died. Why, then, was I not completely surprised when the doctor diagnosed me with liver disease? You've got cirrhosis, she said, studying the pathology report from the liver biopsy she'd ordered the month before when I first tested positive for hepatitis C. I was 46. Without a transplant, she said, I wouldn't live to see 50. Oh, I thought, cirrhosis. For a moment, it didn't seem true. Cirrhosis, I thought. Well, I can live with that. That's when it hit me. It hit hard, in fact, though in retrospect I can't say it felt like a sudden explosion. It felt more as if I had just received an oddly formal, but long anticipated, an acknowledgement of something I had known for a long time, that I would live no longer than my father had. I would not even make it to 50. Hadn't I always felt it, however vaguely, that his death had established my deadline? The doctor handed me a referral. She said she wanted me to see the transplant surgeon. Okay, I told her. But even as I took the slip of paper, I was thinking, why bother? My fate seemed clear enough, even if I didn't have the same form of hepatitis that had killed my father. He died quickly of acute hepatic inflammation, acquired possibly from having sprayed some trees with toxic insecticides a few weeks before. My disease was chronic and viral. Most likely it had been quietly devouring my liver without my knowing it, the doctor said, for more than 25 years. Because it was transmissible only through direct blood-to-blood contact, I'd probably gotten it back in college when I'd experimented with drugs, sometimes sharing needles with my older brother, David, who taught me how to shoot heroin to soften the harsh edges of LSD. As for David, who had suffered from depression ever since our father's death, he had died at 36 of an overdose, which I understood as being his way of following our father to the grave. He's with your father now, my mother said the morning we scattered his ashes. And though I knew it wasn't really logical, my having contracted a life-threatening liver disease seemed hardly coincidental. That is, even if the disease wasn't hereditary, it was nonetheless somehow still familial. This was the thought I carried with me as I left the doctor's office, the transplant referral in my pocket. It was almost dusk. Of course, I kept telling myself. I would always be my father's son, no matter how much I sought to disavow it. Wasn't I the one who most resembled him in looks, as my mother had often reminded me? And wasn't I the one to whom she presented his keepsake watch and signet ring the night of his funeral? When I got home, I made myself a small dinner. I tried to watch a TV movie. Then I thought to phone my mother just to hear her voice, though it was pointless to do so now that she had lost so much of her hearing. Who's this? Who's this? She'd start asking the second she picked up the receiver. I couldn't figure what to do. At midnight, I prepared for bed. I washed my face and brushed my teeth. I undressed in the mirror. Naked, I studied myself in the full-length mirror. There he is, I thought. I could see I was wearing my father's middle-aged body, his hairless chest, soft stomach, calves varicosed with blue veins, as his were, the kind that doctors describe as tortuous. What was the difference between us? I was the son who had been named for him, Richard J. McCann. From visiting his grave every Sunday as I grew up, I knew what my name looked like, carved in block letters on a gravestone. Wasn't it simply a sentimental proposition that boys need fathers to guide them? That's what I thought for years, at least until I needed mine. But how could I possibly initiate a relationship, and in fact, I really wanted one, with a man who'd been dead so long? And how could I locate him? It wasn't as if I could find him simply by looking in the hall closet, where for years my mother had kept his U.S. Army uniform enshrouded in a plastic dry cleaner bag. Here's what I knew for certain in the months following my diagnosis. I was growing steadily sicker, first with fevers, then with a constant intractable itching caused by my liver's diminishing ability to rid my body of toxins. I was becoming almost as jaundiced as my father had been the last time that I had seen him, the night he left for the hospital, his eyes the color of dark urine. When I asked the transplant surgeon how much time I had remaining, he demurred. "I can't say," he said. "Sometimes the liver goes slowly. Sometimes it just crashes like a hard drive." Then he equipped me with a pager to clip to my belt so the hospital could locate me at a moment's notice should an organ become available. And the week after that, he put me on Paxil to dent the depression of waiting for that pager to beep. The transplant social worker gave me the phone number of the man she had chosen to serve as my transplant buddy, a Vietnam vet who'd survived against great odds, she said, since receiving a lung transplant 3 years before. "You'll like him," she told me. "He's a real trooper." When I phoned the man a few days later, he told me he'd been to hell and back, but he figured it was worth it. Now he could help the people who needed him. People like me, that is. He said that if I wanted, I could call him my transplant daddy. He suggested we meet for coffee. But as soon as I set a foot in the bookstore where we'd agreed to meet, I knew I'd made a mistake. There he was, seated at a small table in the rear, tethered to a portable oxygen canister, bloated and moon-faced from prednisone and Imuran and cyclosporin, the immunosuppressive drugs that kept his body from rejecting his lungs as foreign. As soon as I sat down, he started talking. He'd just gotten back out of the hospital, he said, where he'd been fighting a fourth bout with pneumonia. Now he had obliterative bronchitis as well. In the hospital, there'd been some talk as to whether or not he'd need a second transplant. "I've got to go," I kept thinking. I didn't want to stay there, not for one more minute. How could he be my transplant daddy? If I needed a second father, I thought, I needed one who could show me how to live. Not that I was so certain. I wanted to keep on living. Sometimes, lying awake at night, I felt I would just as soon die as submit myself to what seemed a brutal evisceration, during which a piece of a dead person would be sewn inside me. But I couldn't figure how to confide this to my hepatologist, the one doctor who sometimes seemed to me almost a father, however improbably. He was younger than I and shorter than I, and initially from New Delhi, with pictures of Hindu deities hanging on his office walls. But I liked it when he asked me to unbutton my shirt and lie back on the cool white paper of the examination table so he could palpate my abdomen. He gently pressed his hands into my belly, then leaned down to percuss its surface with two fingers so he could assess the size of my swollen liver. I closed my eyes while he worked. Sometimes, as I lay there, I would begin to recall the father of whom I never spoke. The father, the one who sat in the bathtub with me when I was a small child, washing my back with warm, soapy water. The father who came to my room at night when I was sick, laying his cool hand across my forehead in fever. Is it true what the Hasidim say, that when a dead person appears to us in a dream, he is making an actual visitation? If it's true, I don't know how my father found me. For the night he came back, I was on Cape Cod, 500 miles from home, sleeping on a friend's futon. I'd gone there because it was the place I loved most, and I wanted to say goodbye to it now that it was time to say goodbye to everything. Here's how my father returned. He was driving an old DeSoto, waxed to a glossy black finish. I watched as the car advanced, moving slowly down the tree-lined street where we'd once lived, past the identical small houses. I understood in this dream that he was dead. I couldn't tell if he knew who I was, even though I was standing in the middle of the street, right where he could see me. I remember thinking how quiet the street was now that there were no children playing in the yards. The car drew close, then stopped. I could see him inside, though he didn't unroll the window. We just stared at each other through the glass. He had grown no older, though I had. We were the same age now, like brothers. "Come with me," I heard him say, though he wasn't actually speaking. Now that he was dead, it seemed he could speak in a way that didn't need words. I didn't want to get into the black car, not at first, but he kept insisting we had a long trip before us. He wanted to show me something he'd always loved, he said, a locust tree his father had shown him back in the small Pennsylvania mining town where he'd grown up. I remember riding in the car beside him. I remember noticing the door on his side had come loose. It was rattling. Then suddenly we were standing on a tarred country road, examining a large tree that someone had planted on a steep, eroding embankment. Okay, I thought, I've seen it. Now let's go. But my father didn't move. He was looking at me quietly, as if he were hoping I might speak. What was I supposed to tell him? That's when I noticed the tree's roots, how they'd erupted through the hard, dry ground, and how they'd spread in thick, gnarled webs, now that the eroded soil had collapsed beneath them. How could anything possibly live like that, with its roots so horribly exposed? My father was standing behind me. "I'm asking you to live," he said. "No," I told him. Besides, didn't he want me to follow him, as my brother, David, had done? And then we were elsewhere again, walking through an open field behind and at the elementary school my brother and I had attended. It was the field where our father had taken us to fly our paper box kites on windy Sunday mornings. I could tell from the way he was walking with his eyes cast down that I had disappointed him by saying I couldn't live. But even before I could speak, he turned toward me, his expression calm and still. I had nothing to be sorry for, he seemed to be saying, since I had never given offense in the first place. At that moment, I could feel from him a clear emanation, something similar to what the nuns had described to us schoolchildren preparing for First Holy Communion as God's perfect love, the love he has for each of us, just as we are, standing before him and fully known. I didn't know what to say. Something was changing. He wanted me to live. Is that why he'd come back? To tell me that I'd gotten something backward all these years? That I wouldn't be betraying him by living, to be older than he had, as I had imagined, but rather by dying, as he did? When I awoke, my pillow was wet. I'd been crying in my sleep. It was 3:30 a.m. How had my father come and gone so quickly? I must have fallen asleep again, for when I awoke, it was 10:30 a.m. and I was running late. I had a plane to catch. I was headed home for an appointment at the transplant clinic the next morning. And all the way back on the flight from Logan to Dulles, I could feel myself suspended within the dream's debris. I kept trying to remember a passage from Homer I had been required to learn by years before in college class in poetry. The passage in which the warrior Odysseus at last reveals himself to his son, Telemachus, who has awaited his return for 20 years. I am that father whom your boyhood lacked and suffered pain for the lack of. I am he. You can guess how the story ends. I lived. I've lived longer than my father did. I've outlived him now by some years. For how many more I'll live, I don't know. In fact, there is much I'll never really know. For instance, I will never know if I would have allowed myself to undergo the transplant had my father not appeared to me in a dream, giving me permission. I do know that in the weeks before my dream, I had been considering buying an apartment in the DuPont Circle co-op building where an EMT worker had found my brother's dead body on the bathroom floor. Though I told myself the only reason I was considering buying an apartment in that particular building was that the apartment was well-priced, with high ceilings and large windows. I do know that before my dream, driving home from my weekly appointments at the transplant clinic, I sometimes felt the sudden urge to swerve my car into a concrete underpass. I don't know if the dream of my father was it in fact what an Hasidic Rebbe might term a visitation, or if it was simply what Freud would have called a dream of convenience, in which a sleeper's unconscious wish is manifested and fulfilled. I do know that my father sent my brother and me no final note from the hospital that last week that he lived, nor did he send any final words to us to be delivered by our mother. I know I would have liked at least a few such words. And I know this. After my dream, I waited 8 more months for a transplant. Little by little, through those 8 months, shuttling back and forth to the hospital, my liver rapidly failing, I came to realize that everything that was happening to my body had happened to my father's also, though it had all happened to him then in less than a week, as if in fast motion. First, there was the constant exhaustion, a weakening so profound I had to rest on a chair in the hallway to make it from the bedroom to the kitchen. Then the accelerating jaundice, then the ulcerations that bloomed on my ankles from portal hypertension, the pale stool streaked with bile. And after that, muscle wasting as my body cannibalized itself for nutrients and proteins, brief spells of aphasia, cramps and sudden hemorrhages, blood puddling in my mouth from ruptured esophageal varices. My father had bled to death in the hospital with my mother standing beside him. The first time I hemorrhaged from the mouth, I was alone in my apartment washing dishes at the kitchen sink. The blood I vomited was black and thick, like coffee grounds mixed with bloody spittle. It wasn't until 3 days later, after I awoke in the hospital, where I learned a radiologist had saved my life by introducing a small metal shunt into my jugular, then snaking it all the way down to my liver, rerouting my blood flow from the portal vein directly to the vena cava, that I realized I had had the exact same sort of hemorrhage that had killed my father. Had there been no advances in the management of liver disease in the years since his death, I would have died then, too. After that, it grew harder to hold it against him for having left me. In those 8 months, to the best of my knowledge, I never dreamed again of my father, though I often thought of him the way he'd been before he'd gotten sick. I could picture him standing at his workbench, for instance, building birdhouses from scraps of spare wood, or walking down the path from our summer house to the river, pushing back the cattails to clear his way, his wicker creel slung across his shoulder. In the last weeks of waiting for the transplant, I remembered almost nothing. I developed hepatic encephalopathy, the mental confusion and disorientation that often accompany the final stage of liver disease. Sometimes when close friends came to visit, I had trouble recalling their names. I couldn't find the words for the things I wanted, like magazine or pillow or ice cream. Then the transplant coordinator called one night to say the doctors had located a suitable donor. My friend Sarah drove me to the ER, where the transplant surgeon was standing at the ready. I remember walking down the windowless corridor that led to the room where a nurse was waiting to prep me for surgery. I was walking slowly, because I knew it might be the last time I walked on Earth. And as for the rest, sometimes now, when I look back, it's the transplant that feels like a dream, and the dream of my father that feels real. I have never seen my father's autopsy report, if it in fact an autopsy was ever done. But I have read my surgeon's report. I know the transplant took 12 hours and 3 minutes. I know I required 15 units of packed red blood cells, 13 units of fresh frozen plasma, 2 units of platelets for clotting. but I don't remember the surgeon cutting what he describes as a bilateral chevron incision with vertical midline extension with a knife through the skin and then to the subcutaneous tissue and fascia, as his report describes it. I don't remember that, quote, the iron intern with Stiber attachment was replaced for retraction of the ribs, or, quote, how the liver was excised using the curved Mayo scissors, leaving a large cuff of vena cava. I remember waking in the surgical ICU, a tube down my throat, brain buzzing with prednisone. At first, I didn't know where I was, but I knew I was living. I knew a piece of a dead person had been placed inside me. My name was Richard McCann, the same as my father's. Who would I become now? Thanks. Thank you very much.